future is bright, especially if we build for it. Welcome to Architecting the Future, a podcast for the builders of tomorrow, all about people, process, and technology. We hope you enjoy the show.
So, hey, everybody, welcome back to Architecting the Future. I am really excited today to have Vita Williams, who's a friend of our firm, RTS, right here in the Richmond area. Vita, thank you so much for stopping by the show.
I am so excited to be here, Miles. I am such a big fan of RTS and have enjoyed working with them so often over the years. So thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. So I know you're one of the most well-known digital branding officers here in our Richmond network. And I thought just to start, maybe you could tell us, what does a chief digital or chief branding officer do day to day? I know a lot of people probably see that and think, I wonder what skill set that really is.
Absolutely. So I think what's interesting about being an executive in digital is that it has become the entire intersection point for everything else that we do, right? So by career, I'm an enterprise architect and a data scientist. However, the undergirding mechanisms of digital are data. Digital is then looking at innovation differently, right? It's rooting it into the actual business statements, the problem statements of the business. And it is saying, okay, if we do, for example, retailing, what does it look like to do retailing from a multi-channel perspective? And so those kind of intersections of technology and data and systems thinking, that is what galvanized me towards digital. And so I think that is how I am leveraged at this point. But all of it is kind of being interdisciplinary and being able to look at problem statements from all three of those vantage points at once.
And I love that answer. It makes me want to go back a bit to the beginning, because I know you went to Duke, and I was actually a double major, including history in college. I know you majored in history and English. How does one go from being a liberal arts history major, history and English major, to ultimately being at really the forefront of a huge, transformation that is going on in our organizations across America? Walk us through the high points of just how you got interested in this topic and how some of those foundational interests, like you said, have led to all collaborating, converging in this way.
Absolutely. And I think it is a funny story, right? Because we think about this current generation and what their prognoses are for career tomorrow. And it feels vague, right? Well, when I left Duke, it was vague for me, right? There was no such thing as a technologist. There was no such thing as a data scientist. Hidden Figures kind of gave us a backdrop for understanding that, those of us who work in the area of data, once upon a time, were literally just called machines. And so by the time I graduated from Duke and I walked into my first really big, important job, if you will, it was the EPA's data transformation. And they were moving from mainframe systems to a relational model in Oracle, which 30 years later, we would never have done that. It was the most inefficient use cases. However, at the time, it made perfect sense because Larry Ellison was yachting around telling us that it did make sense, and we bought it. And so that was the advent of my career, was trying to understand how to model this big data. Now, ironically, all I was supposed to do is be the technical writer. So all I was supposed to do was to translate into English, these highly technical engineering concepts. But I was so smitten with the process on one hand, and it came so naturally to me to understand how that information worked together, that I really did begin to reflect on the fact that my social sciences background gave me the context through which to understand the human interactions that we were seeing in the data and the ecological interactions that we were seeing in the data. And I think that launched a career for me that had remained largely interdisciplinary. And when asked, especially by younger upcoming, you know, burgeoning technologists and data engineers and scientists, what they should study, I often tell them that understanding the mechanics of technology and data and engineering practices are highly important, but second only to understanding the context in which they are building. And so they needed to shore up in one of the social sciences disciplines. And I stand by that, especially as we move forward and consider the implications of, you know, artificial intelligence, robotics, and machine learning, not to mention virtual spaces.
Yeah, it's such an interesting perspective because you're an example of someone who was really bright as an undergrad who chose what would look like a less practical major, but who has risen to the executive level off your keeping the human centered. And I know if there was a soapbox that you stand on, it is that we need to be more human in the way we treat data because data is about people. Talk to me about that. Right. And I think it's a unique view in a world full of people who are focused on ones and zeros.
Well, it is, and it shouldn't be. It's interesting. So I'm a huge consumer of science fiction. And so I just finished a book. It was written in 92, I think, by Neal Stephenson called Snow Crash. And so forgive my geeky moments in this soapbox moment, if you will. But it's interesting how Neal Stephenson was able to wind in the power of linguistics and the how it has been impacted and by and how it will impact the technological evolution. Right? It was definitely, I think, a satire, but the foundation that he laid, wherein we needed to understand how our language was going to be affected by and affect all of the practices and then all of the structures of technology. Absolutely fascinating. So let me just say, plug, go read it because it's so germane for what we're experiencing right now. But more particularly, I think when I started my career, one of the first things I was able to do was understand the ecological context that led to my own family having a history of learning disabilities and brain cancer in a very small town in Toms River, New Jersey. Now there's whole books written about it. But at the time, as an impressionable 20-something, I was able to pull that data together. I was able to understand that it was a toxic zone. I was able to uncover what company was contributing to the toxic environment that we were being born into, literally, in Toms River, New Jersey. And I was left with an understanding that everything that we were going to do in technology was not only going to elucidate who we are as a society, how we are situated as a planet even, but it was also going to start to be, it was going to be an agent for informing and impacting that. And my entire career has been built around ensuring that humanity is showing up in the decision making that we have as both innovators, but also as corporations who are investing in these innovations. And I think that right now, as we're sitting on the cusp of AI, as we're sitting on the cusp of virtual interactions, as we were talking about earlier, now we're starting to really understand the context and the implications of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's such an interesting topic because it seems like if I could sum up where your success has come, it's your background in social science allows you to ask different questions and to appreciate the answers differently, even though the mechanics are the same mechanics being used broadly in the industry. Is that a simplified way to think about it?
Yeah, and I appreciate that, getting it into a sentence. I might have to cop that from you. But yes, at its heart, I'm an engineer. I would say another way to kind of perceive it is that I think engineers are another type of artists. And as engineers in the space of technology in particular, our canvas is a lot more interdisciplinary than, say, a mechanical engineer necessarily has to be. I think still some of the best mechanical engineers are also artists and understand that their canvas is a reflection of human interaction. But technologists, it's a requirement for us to be good at what we do.
Yeah, it's such an interesting, it's twofold totally. It's like part of it is you've got to be just as good at the ones and zeros, like the implementing the Oracle software. And part of it is, I think you've got to be able to craft a narrative, much like your family background, of the right questions to ask and what to look for. Because I would think there's just too much data to possibly weed through without a narrative. Like, you just don't have the time to, or the even the terabytes of storage in order to just try to capture all of it every time.
Absolutely. And I'll take it a step further, if you will. And I will say that those of us that have spent, you know, 2-3 decades in the trenches at this point, we have to at some point make a decision to go into the executive realms. We have to make a decision to go into regulation and legislation, because if we think about it, those who are making these decisions and how we are trying to craft legislation now around privacy, about accountability, when we think about the Algorithmic Accountability Act that was sponsored in 2019, what are the effects of that? How does it get enforced? Many more of us have to begin to move out of just the realm of bits and bytes and ones and zeros and fingers on keyboards and really intentionally start to translate the effects of this into an English that can be consumed and understood so that we can properly orient our societies around it. There's a danger right now that not enough of us are in these spaces. And so the decisions are being made on bottom lines that ultimately are going to not be as effective as profitable. And that's going to cause a lot of problems, I would say, over the next 10 to 15 years. So being on the forefront of understanding the intersection of technology and humanity, I think, is the responsibility of our generation of early adapters.
And are you scared for the potential for technologies like AI to negatively disrupt our society if more people don't hold to your view of the importance of humanity?
Am I afraid of it? I would say, honestly, I'm more invigorated by it. I am excited by it because I think there are risk points if we don't have broader representation in the engineering. I think that there are risk points in that, you know, we say that we don't want to have bias in data. And my thing is, at this point, the biases that are inherent in the data are representative of the societal norms. And so in order to change the data, we have to change the societal norms at this point. We can't just clean it out of the data. And so what AI is doing is being reflective and refractive, unlike just reporting, wherein, you know, we're using data to determine new decisions. Then yes, absolutely, we should debias it. But at this point, AI is being reflective and refractive of our actual societal norms. I think we have an opportunity through this technology advancement, through this evolution, to confront our own societal weaknesses and fracture points and shore them up. So I don't say that I'm one of those. I kind of split the difference. I think the risk points are more contextual than they are universal. And I think with more of us who are acknowledging and willing to be accountable for what we're building, we're going to create more opportunity than we will harm, understanding that harm is sitting at the shadow of what we're doing.
Yeah, it's a great way to say it. I think there's always going to be risk, but there's a lot of opportunity, and that risk and opportunity are kind of two sides of the same coin. If it's just
absolutely,
yeah, it's an opportunity if we make it one. So you have actually executed digital transformations, which is a bit rare, because I feel like we all hear this word 9,000 times a day and have been for like the last decade. And I still think there's a lot of people who are like, what does digital transformation mean? How do I apply it? So talk to me about the nuts and bolts of how you define digital transformation. And if you're at a mid-major organization like you've been privileged to lead, how do you kind of get started?
For me, a digital transformation project is rooted in the business, right? And I think that lesson comes from, and this is really going to date me. I used to spearhead some of the big ERP implementations that notoriously failed to over 75%. And they failed mostly because we thought that the technology was going to inform the business practice. And that was a growth area. It was a moment of evolution that I think we had to go through as a as an industry that is technology. And by that, I mean both the architecture and the data, right? Like when you're really talking about transforming through technology, there was this misunderstanding, and it was an evolutionary growth point, I think, a maturation point, if you will, that we had to understand that technology is going to enhance but not replace the business processes. So fast forward another 15 years, now we're in the space of digital transformation. A lot of that transformation is rooted in the fact that our systems have become stabilized, right? A lot of us have gone more cloud-based. A lot of the on-prem is either intentional or is deprecating. So much of the infrastructure has been paid for, put in place, and has a roadmap for stabilization and evolution. Once that happened, then the question became, well, how does data inform progress and can data start making a business money, right? At the end of the day, that's the big question that is the focus of any digital transformation is how do you root your transformation into profitability or productivity for whatever the entity is, the enterprise that you're supporting. And so for me, it becomes a very tactical exercise of what is the business model? How are we defining success in that business model? What are the core supports for that business model? And which parts of those core supports can be digitized, automated, or, you know, any other more efficient tool set for galvanizing, evolving that particular effort? And so for me, it's an engineering quandary. It's an engineering quandary that is literally based on the business model of the company. That is why I think my approach has been fairly successful over the years, is I don't think it's me being magical, nor do I think it's me just building content, but it's me actually looking at the business model. And again, from a very systems approach, a very interdisciplinary measure, begin to roadmap what pieces and parts need to be prioritized to automate, digitize, et cetera, until we get to a systemic change.
Yeah, I really like that perspective because it seems like it's kind of an anti-shelfware mindset where so much of the work of digital transformation, if it's not rooted in business realities and conversations with those stakeholders, is just useless innovation.
Oh, yeah. But it's fine. Right? Like, I don't want to dismiss that part of it, too. I just think that from a digital from an executive who is accountable for digital transformation, put your fun innovation in a lab and allow them to go crazy, allow us to go crazy in it, but don't keep your eye off the ball that is the business, right? Like that is the balance between the two. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I don't want to also make it so methodical that there's no fun, and innovation is the fun part. That's why people do it. It is the artistic part of what we do.
And I'm curious, if you were going back to Vida coming out of Duke in 2023, what advice would you give yourself knowing what you know now?
Knowing what I know now, I probably would have jumped out entrepreneurially earlier. I think I had a great number of ideas. I think I understood very well where the industries were going. But I did not have the resources, and I did not have the I didn't have the structure in place to really jump out and take advantage of it. I think had I been able to jump out earlier, I think our founders would have been more diversified. I think our point of view on what innovation impacts were going to be would be more comprehensive. I think the ideas that come from being a Black woman who has been committed to innovation, technology, and data has been largely lost when we look at the narrative of the history of technology over the past 30 to 40 years. And I think it's to the disadvantage.
Yeah, and I think it's really cool now to see you as a leader. And I know you and Joe really connect on this, kind of passing the ladder back down to the next you and realizing, yeah, that what you didn't have or weren't aware of, I mean, even just being on media shows like this, you're sharing that so other people can really realize, you know, be bold, believe in yourself. And I think, you know, to your point, really bring a voice in this technology industry to underrepresented people, because it's critical to, you know, both the success of these ventures, but also I think the ethics of these ventures as we keep scaling them. Well, Rida, thank you again for coming on. We look forward to tracking your progress and having you back on again soon.
Absolutely. So thank you for having me.